Okay. Any remaining questions on the material we discussed before the break? Yes. Okay, they have no choice about the past karma that led to that.
Yeah.
There is a question of the extent to which you can get into that person and give them a range of, it may be a really limited range. Again, this in past karma, I've been emphasizing the power of present karma. There are times when past karma really is pretty overwhelming. But when you can teach someone who has that, in that state of mind, you can try to give them new perceptions or sneak new perceptions in so they can actually see that, okay, there are some things they're doing that are having an impact on other people. They don't want to harm the person. That you want to maximize that with that person. But again, you've got to, with this karmic account, sometimes it's a pretty heavy karmic account coming in from the past, and so you have to say, okay, what's the most skillful thing I can do in this situation, given the parameters, and kind of work within that. And this is where equanimity as to what you cannot change is important. You say, okay, I can't bring this person all the way to, you know, total, you know, looking after themselves with ease, but maybe at least I can help them make choices, have them have, give them some sense of the impact that their choices are having on other people. Because they do make choices, it's just that their sense of what's going on is very warped. I have a few more remarks to make before we get into the passages. Given that we've got this complex system of karmic results, to what extent, in one aspect of it, it really is a problem because complexity is unstable. And secondly, because it is complex, sometimes it's hard to see the patterns. You think you're doing something right and boom, it comes back in your face. You don't know whether did you do something wrong then, or was this the result of some past karma that's come in and just kind of snuffed out what I intended to do? This is why a teaching is needed. Someone who's been able to step back and look at the whole picture, see the large picture, and then give you the perspective you need on things. However, complexity can be part of the solution. If you were in a linear pattern of just A causes B causes C, you really can't get out of the pattern. But because you have these feedback loops, you can actually come back and reconsider things and change things. It helps to remember that these complex systems all come from simple systems interacting. So one thing that's good to remember is, okay, choose to do the most skillful thing you can, and that's going to help in the direction. It also gives you the freedom in the present that allows for your choice. That change your views and change the way you pay attention to things can also change your intentions. Here again, talking about that person, you can give them a little background. Okay, this is what's actually going on here. And the kinds of intentions they would have in a different world could be more skillful. This is why the act of teaching makes sense. In fact, that people can choose to change their ways. Finally, the undoing of the system undoes itself. In other words, you explore the possibility of free will in the present, and that leads to a freedom that goes beyond causality. This is what the Buddha calls the karma that leads to the end of karma. Now, it doesn't cause the unmade, and I said, but it doesn't depend on the unmade, but it can lead there. Just like the road to the Canadian Rockies doesn't depend on the Canadian Rockies, and doesn't cause the Canadian Rockies, but it gets you there. And because of the arrow of time in a complex system, that means ultimate freedom, once it is found, cannot be lost. Once you've totally gotten that total freedom, you don't lose it. Now, there are a couple of ironies here, particularly when we think about that issue I raised at the beginning of the morning about how some people say, well, let's forget about karma and let's focus on interconnectedness as a basis for our choices of action. It turns out when you look at dependent co-arising, it's not just a vague principle of interconnectedness. It's actually a very specific map of how your present intentions, including fabrications, etc., informed by ignorance lead to suffering, but when they're informed by knowledge can lead to the end of suffering. In other words, dependent co-arising is not an alternative to the teaching on karma. It actually shows about, it's all about karma, how karma can lead to suffering and how it can also lead away, if you do it right. To the extent to which we are interrelated, it's not through our being. We don't interbe, but we interact. And it's not something that's just kind of given. Those actions can be good or bad. You can have some interactions with other people that are really, really negative. That's the kind of thing you want to celebrate. And other interactions are really positive. That's the kind of thing we really like. But in either case, they're unstable. The best actions are the ones that would take us out of that interrelationship. That basically would give us the freedom of total, total nirvana, total freedom of suffering. In two senses, dependent co-arising then is actually anti-interconnectedness, in the sense of being interconnectedness of all beings. One, it deals with that aspect of your experience that you don't share with others, your suffering, the things that you're doing within that are causing that suffering. It's all about inside you. You can't bring it out and show it. This is one of the problems of talking about this kind of thing, is that, and that someone who, say, has had an experience of the deathless can't come back and say, here, look, here it is. But they can say, okay, this is what you can do, and you get a sense of their vocabulary and begin to apply it to your experience. And as you see that it begins to make sense and it begins to work, that's how you begin to internalize the teachings. And secondly, as I said, it's a map for how to getting out of our shared experience, because nirvana is, as I say, bachatang, it's totally individual. It's yours. And unfortunately, you can't share it with other people. You can teach them the way, but you can't give it to them. So that's the talk on causality. It took a long time. So, any questions on that last section or any parts of it before we go into the readings? Yes? Okay, arahants still have intentions, but they don't turn them into karma. They say the analogy they give, the Buddha many times uses the analogy of the seed. You plant the seed, and then the seed is going to grow. He says the arahants have seeds, but then they burn them. If you knew how, you'd be an arahant. Yes. Well, we can talk about is how to get there. I can't tell you about what their magic abilities are once they got there. But
so that's about the end of intention or cessation of intention.
Well, again, they have desires, but they don't lead to karma consequences. Like an arahant can want to help you, but they don't suffer from it. Good luck. Anything else? Yes.
In passage 15, the part where the whole cycle, you have ignorance and fabrications and consciousness. What type of consciousness is that? Is that the ear or eye consciousness?
That's the consciousness of the six senses, yeah. There is a type of consciousness that the Buddha occasionally mentions that lies outside of the senses, i.e. that would be the consciousness of awakening.
Usually when he says consciousness...
Consciousness, in this tense, he's talking about the six senses. There is a sutta, unfortunately it's not in either of those volumes. We're coming out with a new volume as soon as I get the index of the Sanyutta. And in Sanyutta 12.2, it goes into the definitions for each of these terms, independent co-arising. That gives you a more detailed account. Yes. If you translate the word karma into English, it is action. And the Buddha is saying it's the intention that causes it, that determines the quality of the action. Yeah. Okay, let's look at some of the readings. Passage 8 is basically the Buddha's description of his night of his awakening, the three knowledges. And so you see the first knowledge had to do with his previous lifetimes. The second knowledge had to do with his knowledge of the passing and away and reappearance of beings. It's in the second knowledge that he gained his insight into karma, when he just looked at his own sort of slice of many, many lifetimes. The pattern wasn't clear. This is because, as we'll see when we get further into the readings, if we ever get there, that sometimes you can do something really unskillful in one lifetime and then have a good destination in the next lifetime, or vice versa. Sometimes it's, and then the times when it's, you know, skillful action in this lifetime or skillful accumulation of actions in this lifetime will lead to good results. Accumulation of bad actions in this lifetime will lead to bad results immediately. But sometimes the results take a long time to work out. And so looking at his own series of narratives, he wasn't able to see the pattern. It was when he saw all beings throughout the universe, that's when he was able to see the pattern. That it was through their actions, as informed by their views, and their either their respect or lack of respect for noble ones, that determine whether people go to a good destination or a bad one. And he saw, okay, because actions are intentions, and these intentions are informed by views. The question that occurred to him, and this is what's really distinctive about his series of knowledges. What if I apply that to the present moment? So he took that knowledge that he saw on the large scale and applied it to his mind in the present moment. This is the principle of scale invariance that we talked about. So is there a kind of intention that can actually get out of the cycle, or a kind of views that help get out of the cycle? And the intentions, then he discovered, were the Eightfold Path, and then the including right views. And it's through that he was able to reach the end of action, reaching the cessation of stress, the cessation of the effluence. Effluence here are, the connotation of the word is that it's something that flows out of the mind and creates more becoming. In this case, you have sensuality, becoming, views, and ignorance. Or here it's sensuality, becoming, and ignorance. But the end of that, that was when he gained full awakening. There's an interesting pattern here. You've got a narrative knowledge and the narratives of his many lifetimes. You have a worldview, the worldview of beings dying and being reborn. And then you have an analysis of things in direct experience. So the three knowledges come in different terms. There's a narrative, there's a worldview, and then there's the direct experience of the present moment. This is also a useful pattern for meditators. You're coming home from the office and you've got lots of narratives. You may not have as many narratives as the Buddha had, but they're filling your mind. And the best way to get out of that those narratives is not to go straight to the breath. You go to the larger pattern first. You start thinking about, okay, this is what the human life is like. Look at things in the larger pattern, and then you can focus in on the present moment. This is one of the reasons why they spread goodwill to all beings before meditation, is to get that larger perspective in mind. It can also help times when you're sitting there and no matter how much you try to stay with the breath, it's not working, and you say, I'm a miserable meditator. And then you can remind yourself, how many people in the world are actually meditating right now? Not many. So at least, you know, if you've been the miserable, but you're in the miserable part of the 1%. And that's quite a leg up on the rest of the 99. I sometimes people say, well, doesn't that risk giving a bad ego? And I said, well, at that point, you need a little ego to give you a boost. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, when the Buddha had these three knowledges, it was the final one that gave the proof for the other two. He had the knowledge of his many lifetimes. He had the knowledge of the workings of karma. But it wasn't until he used that knowledge to gain full awakening that he confirmed that the other two knowledges were actually true. So it's the third knowledge that was the most important of the three. However, for us, we start out with karma and rebirth as our working hypothesis. When we talk about faith in, or the role of faith or conviction in Buddhism, this is what it is. It's your working hypothesis. Again, the question of free will. I can't prove free will to you. Nobody can prove free will. The question is, does karma really work this way? You can't prove it until you've actually put this into practice as a hypothesis and see that it really does work. Then you confirm it for yourself. So are there any other questions or comments on that passage number 8? Yeah, you can't just listen to it. You have to do it. Yeah. Otherwise, you just sit there. Is this really true? Is this really true? I don't know. You never get anywhere. Mm-hmm. Nothing on passage 8? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing in his mind that's going to lead to another world. Once he's done with this one, he's done. Mm-hmm. But you can see he's not a lazy kind of sit around, go with the flow kind of person. We talked about that last night. And he walked across northern India. How many times? That's many, many times. Teaching. The day he was going to die, he walked several hours because he knew there was one more person he had to teach. So it was that kind of determination to do it, you know, finish his job. Mm-hmm. Okay, passage 9. Passage 9 is the only passage in the canon that actually defines karma as intention. But here the Buddha also points out that karma is complex. Some of it leads to, it's to be experienced in the realm of common animals, hungry ghosts, human world, the world of the devas. The result of karma can be either arising right here and now, arises later in this lifetime, or arises following that. But then he talks about the cessation of karma. From the cessation of contact is the cessation of karma. We talk about contact here as being the contact inside the mind, where there's an attention and there's an intention or perception making contact. When those things cease, the contact among those things ceases, that's when karma ceases in the present moment. And we get there by following the Eightfold Path. Questions on that?
I have a question about intention. I understand when it's very clear that I have an intention to harm somebody, but I think a lot of the time I go through my life with no idea what my intention is. Mm-hmm. So, are there thousands of intentions?
Lots of intentions are going on. We talked last night about it, like being a large corporation, and you're sitting up in the director's office. And there's a lot going on in the corporation the director doesn't know. I mean, you've got some people down there looking at porn on their computers or plotting the overthrow of the director. And a lot of the stuff you're just barely aware of. And there is a bare awareness, or in the sense that there's a kind of a hidden awareness of some of the stuff that's happening. And a lot of what we do in meditation is to get clearer and clearer about, okay, where are the intentions going? Where are the choices being made? Just a simple thing like when you begin to work with distracting thoughts. At first you see, oh my gosh, my mind is in this thought, I've got to get out. And so you learn how to drop that. And then you get quicker and quicker and you begin to realize that there are many stages that lead up to going into the thought. There are some choices that are being made. And you get to a point where you realize that sometimes there's just a stirring in your awareness and there'll be an act that says that, oh, that's a thought about this, and then you run with it. And the act of identifying that as that little stirring as being a thought about this or that, what was the choice you made? What was that based on? And sometimes you have a series of things that you want to think about, and you know, here's an opportunity to go for it. And so this is one of the reasons why meditation helps you see your choices more clearly. You get more on top of the little choices that otherwise you just kind of hand it to your underlings. Say, you can take care of that, you can take care of that. Mm-hmm. Yes? Well, some people actually translate that word intention as choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, the word is implied in a lot of things that the Buddha said. You know, it is possible to develop skillful qualities. It is possible to do this. Some place in the mind is making a choice. Contact, in this particular case, is contact among events in the mind. Like you can pay attention to a perception, or you can attend to intention. In other words, the events in your mind are kind of reflecting on one another. And it's that contact among them that allows you to, say, perceive an intention, to be aware of things that are going on inside the mind. Without that contact, you know, these different functions would happen independently. Like the connections, yeah. Or like they're reflecting on one another. That's why I like thinking of the concept of the committee in your mind. There are lots of little people in there making their decisions. And little billions of synapses firing, okay, and sometimes they turn into a cluster of an idea or a perception or a desire. And then it meets up with other desires. And then you can choose, okay, did these desires go together or not? You know. And if they don't go together, there's going to be an internal conflict. And if they do go together, okay, then they start building on one another. There was a fascinating experiment I read about a while back where they were working with beehives, and they'd gone around and they'd checked the area for all the possible places where the hive could move, and they found one really ideal site. So they covered it up, and they smoked the hive. What they'd done, they'd learned how to interpret bee dances. You know, and they would, and you could see that. Okay, once the hive was being smoked, you could see there was a decision, we've got to move. And so all these scouts were heading around in all different directions. And they come back, and some of the scouts would say, well, off there in the northeast, there's this place we could go, but it doesn't look all that good. And someone came from the southwest, well, it doesn't look all that good, but it's a possible place. And they could begin to notice that as the bees started moving in unison, that meant the different bees were beginning to agree on something. And they got to the point where more than half the hive had finally decided to move, not very enthusiastically, but move to another direction. And then they uncovered the really ideal site. And this one little scout comes back really excited, you know, found the great, you know, ideal location, you know. And by that time, however, the hive had already decided and headed off the other direction. I keep thinking about my own mind when I read that. Kind of a hive mind. Yes.
It's interesting
That's the mind. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're going to complain about the bureaucracy, look into your own mind. It gets the same kind of stuff is going on. Passage 11. We're getting into the sections where the Buddha is beginning to talk about old karma and new karma. And here, with passage 10, just briefly noted that it's what allows the seeds in order to bear fruition is there has to be some greed or some aversion or some delusion. So that question you had about how do you get to the point where you burn the seeds, just take away the greed, aversion, and delusion. That's all. But it's those things are required for these things to continue to be created and to grow. Then the Buddha goes on to talk about three sectarian teachings, which basically all of which, whether they admit it or not, are denying the power of action. And one of them is whatever a person experiences, pleasant, painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, is all caused by what was done in the past. That was the Jain belief, that everything you experience now is totally determined by the past. Another view is that whatever you experience, pleasant, painful, neither pleasant nor painful, is caused by a supreme being's act of creation. In other words, you're born into this world that a God created. And so everything you're going to experience is based on what that God did. Now in Christianity, we have a little bit of leeway here, because if there's anything good you experience, it was created by God. If anything you're bad you experience, it's your fault. But it's basically the same principle. And then finally, another one that teaches, basically denies the power of action, is that whatever a person experiences, either pleasant, painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, is all without cause and without condition. In other words, there's nothing you can do to change it. It's just going to be that way. So he goes to the first group, which is often confused with what the Buddha taught. I mean, if you ask the ordinary person off the street about what did the Buddha teach about karma, he says, what we experience now is based on what we did in the past. It's not what the Buddha taught. Remember, he taught about the interaction of present and past karma. And he says, okay, if you believe that everything was caused by past karma, in that case, you were a killer of living beings because of what was done in the past. You're a thief, you're uncelibate, a liar, etc., etc. When one does fall back, and what was done in the past is being essential, then there is no desire, no effort, the thought that this should be done, this shouldn't be done. That's an important part of his teaching. Remember we talked earlier about how the Buddhist teachings are all about actions that should and shouldn't be done. The categorical teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the categorical teachings on skillful and unskillful karma. But if you deny the power of present action, that means that there's nothing that should or shouldn't be done, because present action shouldn't have any consequences. When you can't pin down as a truth or reality what should and shouldn't be done, you dwell bewildered and unprotected. There's another passage where the Buddha talks about how a teacher's duty to his students is to provide them with protection. In other words, give them knowledge about what should and shouldn't be done. But this kind of teaching would lead you unprotected. And so he gives the same refutation for the other two views as well. So again, here he's not proving that present action has a power, but he says that the whole idea of a path of practice makes no sense unless you see the power of present action. And also talking about what should and shouldn't be done would make no sense. And this is one of the ironies in science. You get a lot of scientists who think that, okay, a scientific explanation of things has to be in, basically deterministic, materialistic laws. But the question is, do the scientists themselves function according to materialist laws? Now, they will talk about a well-designed experiment and a poorly designed experiment. And if someone has poorly designed an experiment or fudged the results, they will say it's unethical. Now they're basically saying that the person has a choice. If the person had no choice, then you couldn't say it was ethical or unethical. So scientists are studying phenomena that they say are deterministic, but they themselves are not conducting science as if it was determined. So. It's getting late in the day. Everybody's kind of Okay. We'll be done soon. Passage 12. Okay. We went over this earlier, that basically what you get in through the senses should be seen as your old karma. Your new karma is what you do now. Then we get to passage 13, which is sometimes used as an explanation, saying that not everything can be explained by karma. But look at what the list is. Because he says, this guy says, some people hold to this view that whatever an individual feels, pleasure, pain, either pleasant or pain, is entirely caused by what was done before, i.e. that first view that we saw in passage 11. Everything comes from the past. And the Buddha says, well, you know that there's some feelings arise based on the bile. In other words, there's, but the list here is basically a doctor's list in those days of various causes of disease. Either your bile was malfunctioning, or phlegm, or your internal winds, or bodily humors, change of the seasons, an uneven care of the body. In other words, you eat a lot of fatty stuff. Harsh treatment for the result of karma. Okay, these are all the various things that doctors in those days would list as causes of disease. Now, if you compare passage 13 with passage 12, you would find that most of these things come under either past karma or present karma. So what he's saying here is that, okay, some of these painful feelings, some of these diseases come from past karma, and some of them come from present karma. Some past karma diseases are things that can be treated, others cannot. We don't have this here in kind of Western medicine, but in Thailand, even Western doctors, after treating a disease, if they find that it doesn't respond to any treatment, saying, it's a karma disease. I don't think that would go over very well in the National Canadian Health System. But Idiopathic. That's their term for karma disease. So basically what the Buddha is saying here in passage 13 is not that things cannot be explained by karma. It's just that you look at things, and it's not just old karma. Sometimes it's your new karma that's causing things. Passage 14 is meant as an introduction to passage 15. This is the first verse in the Dhammapada. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. Now notice those two images. Bad karma follows you. You're pulling it like a heavy cart. Good karma follows you, it's like a shadow. You don't have to carry it, it just comes along. It doesn't weigh anything. That's why those two images are chosen that way. And as I said, this is an introduction to the next topic, which is dependent core arising, because you want to see the extent to which prior to your experience of pleasure, pain, prior to your experience of the six senses, a lot of intentions have gone into that, a lot of mental factors have gone into shaping the phenomena you experience. So passage 14 is a really simple way of stating the basic principle of dependent core arising, which we'll get into next. Okay. So I've gone over some of this so far, so I just want to ask any questions on dependent core arising? We could spend a whole week. But as I pointed out before, the most important things to note are that the sense media, your experience of the senses, comes halfway down the line after ignorance, fabrications, consciousness, name, and form. And in the Buddha's analysis of suffering, once you start clinging, okay, that's when suffering is going to be have to follow. So you want to cut the cycle any time between ignorance and clinging. Pretty much given. Once you've got the clinging, then the rest are going to follow.
And the last seems to me to be talked about suffering, like death.
Aging, illness, and death, all the things that the Buddha defined as suffering, yeah.
Sometimes that's described as well, there's kind of two ways that can go.
Yeah, it's if you think of suffering as a kind of feeling, you'll notice that feeling appears many times in the lineup. In other words, there's the feeling that comes under fabrications, there's the feeling that comes under name and form, then there's feeling itself as its own separate factor, and then there's the feeling of pain that comes with the suffering. So you've got it four times there in the dependent core arising. And what this means is that it can function. You could have a loop back, a feedback loop, that there's a feeling that's coming up and then you go back and you reconsider it. You pay attention to it in a different way, and that's going to determine the outcome and go in a different way as well. Or you can change your intention around the feeling, and that'll move it off in a different direction too. There is another thing that's called transcendent dependent core arising. When you get to the suffering, and then from suffering there comes conviction. In other words, the conviction, there's got to be a way out.
Right. This sucks.
Yes, this sucks, you know. Or as I was explaining Sung Wega to somebody one time, he says, life sucks and then you die. And it's basically, there's got to be a way out of here. And this is the principle that the 12 steps operates on. You hit rock bottom and it's okay, then you're ready for the 12 steps. You know. But then from conviction comes, I've forgotten what the lineup is, but eventually you get into states of concentration. There's a sense of, okay, there is a way out. I'm finding the way out. There comes joy, and then there comes concentration. Then there comes wisdom, and finally you can get out. So it's through contemplating suffering in the correct way, paying attention to it in the right way, reshaping your intentions around it, bringing more knowledge to it. Right, and that's actually bringing knowledge rather than ignorance to the process. It can, all the good things come in at that point. Yeah. Okay, under passage 16, goes into some of those factors in more detail. Let's read it backwards. Start down at the bottom. Which ignorance, not knowing stress, not knowing the origination of stress, not knowing the cessation, not knowing the way of practice, leading the cessation of stress. Another way of phrasing this is not knowing things in terms of stress, in terms of the origination of stress. In other words, you don't frame your life in terms of the Four Noble Truths. You frame the terms in terms of what I want, what I don't want, who I am, who I want to be, those kinds of things. That's ignorance. So look at this experience, though, from, okay, where is the suffering here? What am I doing to contribute to the suffering? Okay, then you're looking at it with knowledge. You're bringing the right questions. And that changes the whole tenor of the remaining factors. However, if you go, and so building on that, we're working up from the bottom, fabrications. You've got the three fabrications I talked about earlier, bodily, verbal, and mental. And again, those are going to have a different outcome depending on whether you approach them with ignorance or with knowledge. Like if you fabricate your breath in a skillful way, you come into situations feeling much better. If you direct your thoughts and evaluate things in a skillful way with knowledge, you're actually going to be trying to figure out not so much how can I get chocolate out of this person, but okay, where is the suffering in here and then my desire for chocolate? Maybe I've got to deal with that. So that's directing your thoughts in a different way. And the same with perceptions and feelings. Consciousness here, as we explained earlier, Barbara, is the six consciousness of the six senses. And name and form, as we talked earlier about, that's physical, basically physical phenomena and mental phenomena. The form here is the four elements. And then name is feeling, perception, intention, contact, and attention. Passages 17 and 18 go over the meaning of fabrication. The one with Sister Dhammadina, she explains bodily, verbal, and mental fabrication in more detail. Passage 18 gives another explanation for fabrication. It says these six bodies of intention. This is where fabrication gets equated with intention, and we already saw that intention was equated with karma. So the fabrications here are kind of your karma in the present moment around the six senses. And then finally, passages 19 and 20 get into the issue a little bit of the complexity of karma. For anyone who says, in whatever way a person makes karma, that is how it is to be experienced, there is no living of the holy life, there is no opportunity for the right ending of stress. But for anyone who says, when a person makes karma to be felt in such and such a way, that is how its result is to be experienced, there is the living of the holy life, there is an opportunity for the right ending of stress. Now, the difference here is that okay, you do something negative, and the first version is basically saying, you killed somebody by hitting them 100 times. Okay, you will have to be hit 100 times and die in order to pay off that karma. That's what the first person is saying. The second person is saying, okay, you do something negative, there's going to be a negative result. It doesn't necessarily have to be the same amount. So it's, and he gets into why further down. He says, look at paragraph 3. In a trifling evil deed done by what sort of individual takes him to hell? There's a case where a certain individual is undeveloped in body. This means that pleasure can invade your mind and remain. Undeveloped in virtue, undeveloped in mind, i.e. pain can invade your mind and remain. Restricted, small-hearted, dwelling with suffering. A trifling evil deed done this sort of individual takes him to hell. Okay, so the things you have to develop here are virtue, and the ability to not let pain or pleasure overcome your mind. And then finally learn how not to keep your mind small-hearted and restricted. Okay, so to train your mind not to be overcome by pleasure, this is what concentration practice is good for. On the one hand, concentration practice gives you an alternative to sensual pleasure. So when the sensual pleasures come, you don't get so taken away. And eventually also learning how to keep your mind concentrated, you've got to learn how not to go jumping into the pleasure of concentration. You've probably seen this happen to yourself. You sit there and try to get your mind to settle down, and as soon as it settles down, you fall asleep. What happened? There was a moment of pleasure, you jumped on the pleasure. You left the breath. It's okay, the pleasure comes, you have to say, no matter how much pleasure is going to come, I'm going to stay with the breath. I'm not going to let it pull me away. And as you stay with the breath, you find more and more pleasure comes. And you say, okay, just keep up that determination. Like, I'm not going to let it pull me away from the breath. And so it's this way that you learn how not to be overcome by pleasure. Some people say, I can conquer the pleasure of jhana by not doing jhana. No. Because you need the pleasure of jhana first to pull you away from other pleasures. The cheesecake and the chocolate and the alcohol and all these other things we were talking about today. You've got something better with the concentrated mind. But to get that mind properly concentrated, you can't even let yourself get overcome by the pleasure of the jhana. So you keep your focus, maintain your focus, regardless of how really pleasant it gets. You're not going to just kind of wallow in the pleasure. And that's how you train your, that's how you become, as the Buddha says, developed in body. Developed in mind is you learn how to deal with pain in such a way that it doesn't affect your mind. So for instance, you're sitting here meditating and pain comes up in your knee. You say, okay, I'm not going to go there. I've got an alternative place to go. I've got the comfortable breath. Step one. Step two, you say, okay, that comfortable breath, let's see if we can make it go through the pain and maybe dissolve some of the pain away. You're learning how not to run away from the pain. Now you're learning how to deal with it. You've got some tools to deal with the pain. That gives you more confidence. The third step is you start actually going in and examining this sensation of pain and ask yourself, what are the perceptions I hold around the pain? Do I hold the perception that this is a big solid mass? Is it really a solid mass? In other words, question your perceptions. Now notice what you're doing here. You're taking those elements of present karma, the perceptions, your attention, the questions you're asking, and you're using them to keep the mind from being overcome by pain. So as you develop these skills, again, through the meditation of, I can be here with the pain and it doesn't feel threatening, then you're learning how not to be overcome by pain. And when you learn those abilities, then the results of past karma are going to be less and less. Past bad karma. There's some other perceptions that I found helpful. One is, if you're ridden in one of those old station wagons where the seat faces back, and you're sitting there and all the things come whizzing past you and go away, whizzing past you and go away. Well, think of the pain like that. There's these moments of pain that come, and as soon as you see them, they're going away, going away, going away, rather than coming at you, coming at you, coming at you. It's a different feeling entirely. I found this very useful one time. I was in Singapore, and I was taken to a Chinese doctor who decided to treat my, I had some pain in my back. And of course, his way of treating pain in the back was to create more pain in the back. He starts rubbing this oil into my back, and at first it feels really good. And then he starts really rubbing it in until it's getting kind of raw. And then he takes these bamboo sticks. You know, take a piece of bamboo and you slice it very thin so it's like a brush and on my back. And fortunately I had that perception that I can think, okay, the pain is going away, going away, going away, going away. And got through it. And of course it felt really good when the doctor stopped. But, you know. but I found that in normal sitting meditation, that's a really helpful perception to hold in mind. There's pain coming up and it feels like it's throbbing. Each throb, it's going away. Each throb, it's going away, going away, going away. So that you're not receiving the pain coming at you. And your relationship is very different. Any questions on passage 19?
I have a question on 16.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, in this passage, he's going through the whole lineup. But what I wanted to focus on was the ones that were related to karma.
Oh, so this passage is complete?
No, it's not complete. No. Otherwise, it would have been 35 pages of notes. And finally, passage 20, the precise working out of results of karma are inconceivable, that is not to be conjectured about. It would bring madness and vexation to anyone who conjectured about it. This is where the Buddha is basically saying it's really complex, and if you try to work out all the details, you go crazy. All you have to know is the simple principles. You act on skillful intentions, and you try to abandon unskillful ones. And then that will work out in the direction you want it to go. So, any questions before we quit for the day? They said we'd stop at 4:30, but I'm not committed to that. Okay, I've dragged you through a lot of complex material today, so I'd like you to take it home and think about it, and tomorrow morning, if you have any extra questions, we'll meet here at 9. Yes, you have a question?
It's a question, and it goes way back to the reading number 4.
Okay. Sure, yeah, anything up through 20 is fine. Yeah.
So it's two things about the sensual misconduct section on that. Mm-hmm.
They're actually focusing on the sexual behavior for that one. It's kind of like one of those euphemisms, a sensual misconduct. We have all kinds of words for this that you wouldn't want to say in polite company. This is the polite word. He's focusing on the kinds of sexual misconduct that are going to give rise to resentment. You know, that there's somebody else who's protected, like the number of things that are about people who are being protected. Okay, if you have sex with someone who is being protected, the other people are going to resent that intensely. And that seems to be the point of all this, is to avoid resentment. So no minors, nobody who's already married, or even crowned with flowers. That's in fact the old days, and you didn't give your girlfriend your varsity t-shirt, your varsity sweatshirt. You crowned her with flowers. You know. Do they do that in Canada? That would be again in those days. Those were people like the concubines with the queen, the king. And even up until the 19th century, you had in Thailand. I mean, they've had concubines up into the late 19th century in Thailand, early 20th century. And if you messed around with any of those, in other words, sex that gets you into trouble. Now he's not talking about being kind with your sexual energy. I mean, he's not giving advice to people on how to have sex. Okay. He's basically saying, you know, this kind of sex is really going to get you into trouble. Don't go there. And as for what you do, he's not going to talk about it. Yes?
I'm a little confused about when old karma becomes new karma, but how long new karma lasts.
Okay. It becomes old karma, yeah. And so you've got to be on top of what you're doing, what the next choice is coming up, the next choice coming up, the next choice coming up.
So like in that section about phlegm and et cetera, that's supposed to be new karma.
Okay, the phlegm, the fact that you have a body that has malfunctioning bile and malfunctioning phlegm, okay, that's a result of old karma. Now the question is, what you're going to do with it right now? And it comes into the treatment that you give to the disease. That would be your new karma. Cause certain actions. Again, but you can pull back from them and say, I'm not going to go there. Now look at the case of the person with psychological problems. Some of that could actually be caused by physical malfunction. And that's a case where, you know, the old karma is so strong that it's really getting in to affect the mind. In which case you have to be very clever in dealing with that person, kind of getting into their reality and then trying to make some sense out of that reality so they can make some wiser choices. Well, the Buddha says if you take that as a working hypothesis and you work with it, you find that it works, basically. You know, in the beginning you may say, oh my gosh, I've got so many bad habits and they come in, I don't know if I can overcome them. And they seem to come in to be having a huge effect on your decisions. And he says, well, make the best of what you got. And as you basically open up that area, you find that there's more freedom in there than you thought there was. So, I mean, the whole idea, this is one of the reasons why I think his talking in terms of skill as opposed to good and bad is really helpful, because there are gradations of skill. It's not black, white. It's, okay, this is more skillful than that, but then that's more skillful than this. You can kind of work your way up. Is everybody satisfied for the day? Okay, we'll stop for there.